Management. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Chamber Music Northwest, featuring the 2017 Summer Festival, which started June 26 with 5 weeks of music, over 30 concerts, more than 60 artists and ensembles, 8 world premieres, 2 theatrical experiences, and a celebration of women composers that spans 9 centuries. More information at cmnw.org.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/FuzzyBoo.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is licensed clinical psychologist Tracy Stein. Dr. Stein has a master's and doctorate degree in clinical psychology from Columbia University and is the former director of integrative medicine in the Department of Surgery at Columbia University Medical Center. Her work as an expert in integrative medicine has been featured widely from O Magazine to Psychology Today. Currently, Dr. Stein runs a clinical health psychology practice for people struggling with chronic pain, and she's here today on Health Watch to talk about her book, The Everything Guide to Integrative Pain Management: Conventional and Alternative Therapies for Managing Pain. Welcome to Health Watch, Dr. Tracy Stein.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Dr. Stein, in your book, you state that about one-third of the United States experiences ongoing pain, and the management of that seems like we're sort of at a place of a conundrum of sorts, since we're learning a lot of the long-term downsides, say, opioid addiction or even elevated cardiovascular risk from taking over-the-counter drugs like ibuprofen when managing things long-term. So, but before we talk about some of the alternative therapies that you suggest in concert with some of the conventional therapies, maybe we should start with risk factors. What are some of the risk factors that put people at a higher risk of developing chronic pain?
So that's a great question, and certainly it varies person to person, but things that we know contribute to chronic pain risk would be being overweight, being underweight actually, smoking, being sedentary, and having high levels of inflammation. Also, if you think about it today, people work much longer hours than they used to, often 2 or 3 jobs to make ends meet. Their stress levels tend to be pretty high. Social support can actually be lower. People can be more isolated these days. And we know that things like depression and anxiety are associated with higher levels of pain and poor coping.
You also mentioned in the book that being female puts us at higher risk of chronic pain. Yet we don't know whether that's a biological thing or a cultural sociological thing. Can you talk a little bit about the gender dynamic around chronic pain?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do know that women present more for treatment for chronic pain health issues. Certainly, there are some pain issues that are only applicable to females, like vulvodynia or endometriosis or menstrual pain, but women are also more likely to seek treatment. It's really hard to separate out whether the fact that women are also much more likely to be diagnosed with depression and anxiety are causal or correlational. Certainly, we know that people who have chronic pain also tend to have higher levels of depression and anxiety. There's some speculation that hormonal levels and fluctuations in hormonal levels may be a factor in why women are more likely to have chronic pain, but that hasn't really been proven. And certainly the fact that women tend to take on multiple roles. So you'll see women who work and then take care of the home and perhaps a partner and children and maybe even elderly relatives. And the increased stress tends to decrease pain coping and coping in general. So there are a variety of reasons. One problem in understanding why there's this gender difference is because women are often excluded from pain research. So many more studies are done looking at chronic pain in men. Even in animal studies, such as with mice, you'll actually see they're more often done with male mice. And so it creates kind of a knowledge gap that we really need to close to understand what's going on better.
That's really fascinating. And you mentioned the link between anxiety and depression and chronic pain, that if you have anxiety or depression, you're at higher risk of developing ongoing pain. But it's also the reverse, too, that if you have chronic pain, you have a higher chance of developing depression or anxiety. So that seems like an interesting puzzle that hasn't really been untangled as well.
Right. I mean, one of the things that we can take from that, though, that can be a positive, is that many of the therapies that are helpful with managing depressive symptoms or managing anxiety are also helpful for managing pain. And there are neurological reasons for this. It's, you know, people think of mind-body therapies as these intangible, nebulous things, and therefore, you know, maybe not so effective, but they actually can be very effective both for helping with mood issues and anxiety and also with pain.
So can we talk a little bit about mindfulness-based stress reduction, which what I discovered from your book is can lead to quite a bit of pain reduction and also better functioning?
Right. So mindfulness in and of itself is actually separate from mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is an actual program at the University of Massachusetts and now elsewhere. That program was developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who used to be on the faculty there. But mindfulness-based stress reduction includes a yoga component, includes a lot of psychoeducation, and it's a multi-week program, and that's been shown to have a number of benefits for people with different chronic pain conditions. Mindfulness, just the meditative practice, I refer to it as present moment non-judgmental awareness. And what it does is it trains us to focus on what is going on in the now. And that's so important because especially in the United States, we tend to be prone to keeping our minds in the past, so we may ruminate over something that has not gone well for us, or we may long for the past, especially if we're in pain now and we weren't then. Or we'll worry about the future or long for the future, thinking that it'll necessarily be better. And what that does is it takes us out of the moment we're in, and the moment we're in is the only moment where we can ever affect change. With regard to pain, we know that mindfulness practice in the long term causes changes in the brain, both to the structure and function of the brain, so that people actually have greater pain coping and decrease pain severity. But they also have found that in studies, long-term meditators are actually more resistant to chronic to pain in a laboratory setting, so laboratory-induced pain. So there really is a benefit from a pain perspective to learning mindfulness, but also, again, from a general well-being and mood perspective, it tends to address, I think it's a common ailment that we suffer from as a society, that we get so caught up in things that aren't even actually happening and may never happen. And all that does is increase our distress. So mindfulness keeps us in the now.
And I would imagine perhaps it's something that people avoid out of the counterintuitive notion that you'd want to be present with your present moment when you're in pain, being a way towards having less pain, not just coping with your pain, but actually reducing the amount of pain.
Right. It is very counterintuitive, and it can be a tough sell at first sometimes for people, but what I explain to patients is that, again, this moment is the only one we will ever have. This is where our life is happening, and this is where we can affect any change. And, you know, mindfulness also could mean attending to a part of the body that is more comfortable or even simply neutral. So So a very simple mindfulness exercise could mean identifying an area of the body like an earlobe or your hands or the tip of your nose and observing the experience of that pleasant or neutral sensation in that area. And what that can do is actually edge pain out of the way. It can turn down the volume on pain, because what happens is we tend to amplify it by infusing it with so much emotion. Sitting with and observing pain can also, if we're just mindfully attending to the breath and just noticing, okay, there's this or that sensation in my body, can actually help us to find spaces between the moments of pain. A lot of times people will say, well, my pain is constant and it never changes. But actually, mindful awareness of your pain can help you notice when it decreases, not just when it's high, and learn to kind of create more space between the pain spikes.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to clinical psychologist Tracy Stein about her book, The Everything Guide to Integrative Pain Management. For people listening, Tracy, about potentially approaching pain from the mind, from psychology, and from awareness when they're so used to potentially reaching for a pain medication. Therapy itself has also been studied as an intervention for pain. Is there a specific type of therapy that, psychotherapy, that would be beneficial for someone who's a chronic pain sufferer?
Absolutely. So the standard really is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a more structured type of therapy. Sometimes it's time limited, but oftentimes it can be ongoing. And cognitive behavioral therapy helps us in a lot of different ways. So one way is it helps us, you know, by keeping something like a pain diary, it can show us what things tend to trigger spikes in pain and what things tend to alleviate pain or decrease pain. Because again, sometimes it will seem like, you know, nothing helps, but then when somebody keeps a pain diary, they might realize that, oh, actually, when I went for a walk, my pain, despite thinking it would spike, was actually lower. Or taking a 20-minute nap is helpful, but taking an hour nap isn't. Also identifying things like cognitive distortions. So catastrophizing is very common when people are depressed or stressed, but also in chronic pain. And catastrophizing means taking something that's already negative, but taking it to the nth degree and making it as terrible as possible. And we know from the research that catastrophizing actually increases pain severity and decreases pain coping. So identifying cognitive distortions can help people put things in a more realistic perspective. And it also helps them do a reality check. And often what people will find is that, yes, this is unpleasant and I don't like it and I wish it didn't happen to me, but it actually isn't impossible for me to make some of these changes that might help me feel better. Behavioral activation is a commonly used tool in cognitive behavioral therapy, and that simply means engaging in pleasant activities, but scheduling them just like they're as important as any other activity.
So in my own practice, when I see people with either acute or chronic pain, often my first line intervention is acupuncture. And I was curious what your own experience in running pain clinics and the role or lack thereof of acupuncture.
So I think acupuncture can be very beneficial, and certainly the research probably is strongest for pain management with regard to acupuncture. I also do believe in the qi effect, that there is some life force energy that is getting balanced by acupuncture. It really depends on the practitioner and on the clinic, but I think more and more now the conventional medical community is recognizing that acupuncture is an important treatment tool. And more doctors are becoming trained in medical acupuncture. My own feeling is that sometimes it's also good to go to somebody who has done the four-year training and knows probably even more about acupuncture and Chinese medicine. But acupuncture is a wonderful tool, and I think it's worth incorporating in most pain management treatment programs.
And with regards to the sort of the Wild West of herbs and supplements, what are some of the ones that stand out to you as both being potentially safe to use and also with some science behind or some clinical experience behind them being effective?
Okay, so in terms of safety and effectiveness, things like ginger and turmeric, which are spices, can potentially help with inflammation and pain, also with digestion issues. Magnesium, especially for people who have headaches or insomnia, that can be really calming to the nervous system. Omega-3 fatty acid supplementation, whether that's in the form of fish oil or something like krill oil, can decrease inflammation, help with mood issues, and possibly help with pain. Probiotics, I think, it's hard for me to think of a person who wouldn't benefit from using a probiotic, given the brain-gut connection and all of the research that's coming out on probiotics for certainly for a number of mental health issues, but also for immune issues. And I guess unless somebody has something like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or some GI disorder, maybe they would want to speak to their gastroenterologist about, you know, the timing of and what particular strains of probiotics to take. But those, I think, are ones with pretty good safety profiles. If you're taking any medication or a lot of other supplements, it's certainly worth, and it's actually really important to talk to your physician just to avoid interactions. It's important to get a good quality supplement. So websites like consumerlab.com, I think, are invaluable. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's an independent laboratory. Okay, great.
Yeah.
I don't know if your listeners are, but it's impossible to remember everything that's been researched about an entire body of therapies or even just one group. And what I like is that they review and summarize the research for different medical conditions. They note when there have been contraindications or adverse effects. And they do test a number of supplements, certainly not all of them, and even ones that aren't on their list might still be quite good. But they look to make sure that supplements aren't contaminated and also that they contain what they say they do and only what they say they do.
And it might be worth noting also that, say, a substance like turmeric, dosage is going to be important. While eating it in your food is going to be health promoting, it may not be a pain relieving amount of turmeric to
right.
be able to reduce inflammation and joint pain or head trauma recovery, which is one of the things that's been studied for in animals.
Absolutely. And I guess similarly, with omega-3 fatty acids, eating fish a few times a week is great for somebody who can do that and is willing to do that. The thing with fish oil, as you know, is that if somebody's taking blood thinners, they really don't want to necessarily go out and automatically take fish oil or garlic or things like that that tend to decrease clotting, especially not without talking to their doctor.
So what are your thoughts, pro or con or both, on medical marijuana and pain management?
So I had a feeling you were going to ask me about that. And, you know, I certainly don't consider myself an expert on medical marijuana. I consider myself like an expert generalist. But I think there are certainly benefits for some people to medical marijuana, including somebody who has seizures or who has poor appetite or trouble sleeping. A friend of mine passed away a few years ago at the age of 40 from a metastatic cancer, and medical marijuana was one of the things that really improved her quality of life. And, she had to get it illegally at the time. And the risks were worth it to her of doing that illegally so that she could get the benefits, and they were really important to her. So, you know, certainly I think that the risk to most people is probably lower than for opioids. I'm hedging that just because I know that no matter what I say, somebody will be upset by that comment, but it can be helpful. I think if somebody has a personal or family history of psychotic illness, it's probably not the first thing that I would recommend. And somebody, you know, even or people with migraines or some other neurologic issue would probably want to stay in close contact with their doctors, which I recommend anyway. But I'm interested to see more research come out on medical marijuana. I think it could be very promising.
Well, you mentioned, as far as possible, supplement interventions, probiotics, which I'm guessing you're not recommending with regards to direct pain relief, but more for system balancing to eventually lead to better pain management. But correct me if I'm wrong, but it made me think that you would also probably have some thoughts on ways to manage one's diet with regards to having a diet that's reducing inflammation or potentially removing things that could be triggering inflammation in specific places.
Absolutely. Just with regards to probiotics and chronic pain, I'm not aware of any data showing a direct relationship between probiotics and pain perception. It would be interesting to see something like that. But that said, you know, there's all these brain areas, you know, people can, a common misconception is that people think there's one kind of pain center. And as we know, there are multiple areas of the brain involved in the experience of pain. And there's a lot of overlap between those areas and areas related to cognitive functioning and emotion and depression and anxiety. And that's one reason why we sometimes recommend antidepressants and other psychotropics, both for pain and for mood issues. But probiotics, we know, help with with mood issues. And even there's some data on schizophrenia symptoms responding to probiotics and dietary change. So I think
before we go on to diet, though, you mentioned this link between pain and depression, and that sometimes antidepressants are used to help people with pain, not just for mood. Are there alternative therapies that you think of that are both addressing pain and depression at the same time?
Well, certainly cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, anything like mindfulness that helps one be in the present moment. Hypnosis actually can be quite helpful for alleviating especially anxiety symptoms and helping reframe kind of depressogenic thinking and helping decrease pain severity perception. So that would be something I would think of. You know, there's the supplement SAMI, which is S-adenosyl methionine, and there's some data showing that it's helpful for osteoarthritis pain and other types of health issues, as well as for depression. And sometimes it's used adjunctively with antidepressants to help people who don't respond to antidepressants alone. So I think there are a lot of therapies that work on both pain and mood.
Sorry to derail you about the diet, but if you have some thoughts on where people could begin to sort of parse out what would be a diet that is not contributing to inflammation and pain.
So I'll probably say what I'm assuming you and many of your guests have said, but, you know, a whole foods, unrefined diet, heavy on the vegetables and fruit, maybe some fatty fish. These are types of things that reduce inflammation. I know people are split with regard to whether grains are beneficial. I personally eat them. But, you know, not overdoing that and not eating ones that are refined. Looking for things like emulsifiers in packaged food and just avoiding them, avoiding trans fats. Both of those can contribute to inflammation, and there's no nutritional value to them. A whole foods, unrefined as possible diet, watching or avoiding alcohol, watching or avoiding caffeine, these things can help people feel better in general and also get weight under control if that's an issue, whether the weight is too low or too high. So that's typically what I would recommend, and maybe adding some fermented foods like kimchi or sauerkraut for people who enjoy them.
And then with regards to starting an exercise program, that seems to be a particularly complicated thing if people are experiencing pain when they're moving.
Right.
How do you go about that? And are there specific forms of exercise that go with specific conditions that you would want to highlight?
So exercise is important for everybody, as you know. The problem is, like you suggested, that when people are in pain, they really don't want to move. And the problem with that is their muscles continue to tighten or atrophy. They can have disc issues from inactivity. But it is really challenging once someone is already in pain to get them moving. but especially for people who weren't active before. Exercises that tend to be helpful and more doable would be gentle movement like Tai Chi, which also helps reduce the risk of falls in people who are prone to them and improves balance. Qigong, gentle yoga, not necessarily the athletic, vigorous yoga you might see at like a celebrity gym or a trendy gym, but something more restorative at first. Walking at whatever pace somebody can comfortably do. And I just try and remind people that this is an investment in their health over the long term. And I try to get them to identify other goals that they'll be more likely to be able to attain if they commit to the temporary increase in discomfort from becoming more active. So I emphasize that it will be temporary. But like, say, a mom who has small children and has been bedridden with pain or depression or both, you know, maybe a goal would be to walk her child to kindergarten. And if you're in so much pain that you can't bear to move, that's a tough one. But the emotional valence of something like that can prompt somebody to breathe through the temporary surge in discomfort because they can visualize the reward that has greater value than avoiding discomfort.
Well, and also, this isn't specific to pain, but your section on the risks of prolonged sitting with regards to premature death was certainly a motivator for me when I read it.
I just imagine that as a health professional, you're quite active. So I'm not buying
I'm pretty active, but it's also, you know, like the little bit of extra movement that someone can do in terms of the amount that it will lower your risk of premature death is pretty remarkable.
Oh, definitely. I actually bought a really inexpensive, comparatively expensive, it's like a $75 standing desk attachment. And when I'm not seeing people, if I'm doing paperwork, sometimes it's helpful just to, even for 20 minutes or a half an hour, to be standing. Or if I'm on the phone like I am now, I might be pacing just to get a little bit of extra movement going. And, you know, it's helpful for circulation and for general well-being. And little things count. Sometimes people will avoid activity because they think that they can't do anything that's really going to be worthwhile. And really, everything adds up.
And then do you have a first line thing that you reach for when dealing with insomnia that's due to chronic pain?
So there are a few things. Again, mindfulness, there's data showing that it is helpful for insomnia and also the distress related to insomnia because we can get so attached to, oh my God, I only have 5 more hours left. How am I going to get enough sleep? And that just makes it more impossible to actually get any quality rest. I actually really like binaural beats, which many of your listeners may not be familiar with, but it's a very, it's an inexpensive to free technology. There are, recordings people can download from iTunes or free apps or low-cost apps. And basically, binaural beats are a type of brain wave entrainment. So basically, two different tones are played, one in each ear, so you need to use headphones, and your brain hears the difference, the mathematical difference between the tones in terms of hertz. And whatever that difference is, whatever it corresponds to in terms of the type of brainwave, it will actually help the brain move more into that predominant brainwave state. So, for example, somebody who has a hard time falling asleep might listen to theta brainwave binaural beats, and they're usually paired to music, or you could pair them to guided imagery or ocean sounds or pink noise. And basically, over the course of several minutes, your brain will go from a two kind of fast-paced active state to a more early sleep stage type of brainwave activity.
Dr. Stein, I'm just going to leap in because we're almost out of time, and I wanted to give you a chance if you do have a website. Do you have a website that you could point people to?
I do. It's www.drtracystein, and it's Tracy with an I. I have a Facebook page and Twitter. I post a lot of health-related things on Twitter if people would like to find that out. And actually, I have, a blog post on either Psychology Today or goodtherapy.org about binaural beats, so people can read more about that there.
Thanks for being on Health Watch today, Dr. Stein.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We're talking today to clinical psychologist Dr. Tracy Stein about her latest book, The Everything Guide to Integrative Pain Management. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 17th Annual Portland Zine Symposium, July 22nd and 23rd, from noon to 6 p.m. at the Epano Jam Space in Portland. The Portland Zine Symposium will feature Skillshare workshops, panels, and unique tapers focusing on self-publishing, social justice, expression, and more. Again, that's the 17th Annual Portland Zine Symposium, July 22nd and 23rd, from noon to 6 p.m. at the Epano Jam Space, 8114 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This week on Making Contact. Have you ever noticed that cities have a constant hum? Each neighborhood has a unique flavor because of the people who live there. It's like their own soundtrack. If you go inside, you get a respite, most of the time. But if you live outdoors, the sound of the city is constant. It is you. It's us. In this episode of Making Contact, we go to three cities, from Southern to Northern California, and around the globe to Cape Town, South Africa, all struggling with high rents and low housing vacancies that are forcing some people out of their communities and leaving others with nowhere else to go but the streets. We begin in my hometown, Los Angeles, California, where just about 58,000 people are experiencing homelessness throughout the county.
My name is Tom Waldman, and I'm the Director of Communications for the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority.
Tom's organization is also referred to as LASA. It's a hybrid city and county agency that provides homeless services. One of their big annual projects is a homeless count, kind of a mini census that takes place every January. And this year, the changes were staggering. Altogether, they found 23% more people experiencing homelessness since the previous year.
We were surprised by the magnitude of the increase. We literally are in a situation right now in Los Angeles County where hundreds of thousands of people are living paycheck to paycheck, and it's because of rents more than anything else.
I recently learned that the first step to getting people back into housing can sometimes be the hardest. So there are special outreach teams called emergency response teams, or ERTs, who go out looking for people that want help. They're made up of social workers, nurses, counselors, and outreach workers. Some have experienced homelessness themselves. I went out with teams from two completely different locations. One, St. Joseph Center, which is just a few blocks from Venice Beach. The other is in the high desert community of Antelope Valley, where residents saw a 50% jump in homelessness this past year.
So, everybody ready?
My name is Flora Harris. I'm the program director for C3 program in Venice, California.
We have our peer specialist today, we have our LASA ERT, and then we have our mental health specialist going out with us.
So do you all go out every day?
Every single day. So when we're out asking questions, we're trying to find out if the clients are housing ready. If they have their California ID, Social Security card, we refer them so that they can get case management, so that they can get counseling if they need it, and someone to help them, you know, mitigate some of the other problems that they run into managing their life functioning.
My name is Shaheeb Joseph. I am an outreach worker for Los Angeles Homeless Service Authority.
Shaheeb and his emergency response team, or ERT, work in the high desert on the outskirts of LA County.
for the most part, start the day about anywhere from 6 to 7 o'clock, go load up a truck with supplies, and just go out to these encampments. Well, this morning we've got cold water. I have a few, they're called protein coffee shakes. Homeless have been loving those lately. And, you know, it's a first aid kit in here, hygiene supplies, and a few clothes, blanket or two. They've been asking more for cold water instead of coffee, so. We actually have the largest landmass area, but we do have less homeless than any other area. The physical terrain is dusty in the desert here, you know, so that we do have mountain areas going towards Acton, so it's a lot of places for homeless to hide. It's kind of a road right here.
Wasn't it somewhere like right here on the side?
Right here in this bush, this big bush. I don't see them.
Come check it out.
Tom Waldman.
The ERT groups during the year are engaging with people experiencing homelessness every day, and that's part of the job of ERT groups. They're building relationships of trust, helping people getting into shelter, and one would hope permanent housing.
And so the way they work is one team member approaches the client or a potential client, and the other one stands back to sort of be a lookout, to watch and make sure that nothing either illegal or dangerous is gonna happen.
This part of 3rd Street is a long industrial block. Flora points to body-sized shelters covered with tarps and blankets that line the walls and fences along the street.
There may be someone underneath these things. We don't go there. We don't try and wake them up. We don't infringe on their personal space and their privacy. So we'll very respectfully ask if we can assist them, if they're what their needs are, if they're looking for housing, if they're looking for medical care, if they need case management. And, you know, so it's a very respectful interaction. And we only proceed if they are in agreement to allowing us to take down their information.
Flora and team member Pierre are relieved that a man they've been approaching for weeks has agreed to go to detox and complete their intake survey.
There are those people on the streets who, for whatever reason, don't want to go into shelter. They may be fearful of what they'll experience. They may be mistrusting authority, and they just don't want to have any authority figures who might be running their lives or how that they would perceive it that way.
Sometimes they just really, you know, things they've been through in their life, they don't trust anybody. So that's part of the reason why they're secluded, don't want to be bothered, and try to stick to themselves. But those same people that refuse service, you know, maybe 10 times me seeing them, the 11th time something happened where they've seen me help some other individual, and it's, hey, can you help me like you helped that individual? I want to get off the streets. So a lot of times it takes that long to build, you know, get their trust.
So,
yeah. And then,
I wouldn't say they
you. Oh, yeah, exactly. That was a particular client. She's been out here quite a while. I believe she's let one voucher for housing go through. I mean, drug addiction's a kind of a big reason about it, but she says she's also in pain, though, because she does have some problems going on with her stomach. But I just explained to her, though, we need to get her to the Social Security building so she gets her Social Security card. It's part of her getting a voucher. I just explained to her, like, I'll come back later on today and pick her up and take her there. I'm tired of seeing her out here. She should have been housed. Sometimes it takes a, you know, we have to do a little bit more as far as literally hand walking them to housing. Some will beat down the door and get most of it on their own, but her mother and father are actually out here in the other part of the desert too. Yeah, so it's kind of sad. There's a family history of homelessness.
These clients down here on 3rd Street, they are substance users. They have lost their homes because of their circumstances, mainly sometimes due to alcohol use, drug use, or because they couldn't keep their jobs. So they pretty much lost their homes because of that. And then they just come down here and they develop a community. We had one individual that who had been homeless for almost 15 years. We got her in at our interim housing. as of last Sunday night, she stayed two nights there because she just prefers to be here with her community. She's been outdoors for so long that living indoors has been such a tough adjustment for her, so she continues to sleep on the street. We've had individuals who go into the units and they bring their tents and they set their tent up instead of sleeping in the bed. So, you know, trying to get them housing ready is more than just finding a house for them to live in. It's helping them to adjust to living indoors again, bathing, generalized hygiene, daily hygiene, getting up and eating a hot breakfast, you know, going to bed at a normal time. It's more than getting them housed.
Shahib Joseph.
Things happen in people's lives that they might take a certain way and end up in homelessness, you know, but nobody's better than the next person. Sometimes you don't need organizations to help a homeless off the street. If you have a line on a job, if you have a room to rent at your home, or if you have property where you can actually help someone out, do it. If you can help, help.
Tom Waldman.
One of the unusual things about what we're seeing in Los Angeles County right now is I think there's a kind of traditional sense in American social history that if you see an increase in homelessness, it's a direct result of an economic depression or recession. I mean, I think all of us have, to some extent, that image of hobos from the 1930s during the Depression. But here in Los Angeles right now, the economy is doing fairly well. I mean, unemployment's around 5%, which is pretty low. Nevertheless, we have 58,000 homeless people experiencing homelessness in Los Angeles County.
The ultimate goal is to get them off the street. You know, Peter Lynn, people might think he's crazy sometimes, but he literally says in our meetings, you know, our goal is to end homelessness. Everybody has their opinion about that's impossible or how to get that done, but if we're not working in this field to do that, then what are we doing it for? There's plenty of ways to make money and jobs out there, but that's my goal, is to how can I get this person off the street?
LA voters last year passed measures that they hope will make a real impact on homelessness. One is a countywide sales tax increase that funds the outreach teams we just heard from. That tax generates $355 million a year. Among other services, it also helps to pay for emergency rental assistance to prevent people from falling into homelessness in the first place. We now turn 400 miles north to Oakland, California. Making Contact's Anita Johnson looked at the situation for people experiencing homelessness there with the help of a local homeless advocate.
This is a house I'm building. This was a platform after my trailer burned down on New Year's Eve. And I lost everything. So I had these pallets where I put my tent on. And the tent kept ripping and kept getting wet during the rain season. So I looked online and seen homemade tents. And I seen this structure online. So where they just basically took the bottom of the tent and used it as the roof and put up three boards and used the front of the tent as the front door. I can show you right here.
That's Messiah Ali. He's 43 years old and has lived in Oakland for most of his life. He's invited me inside his home, a home with a ceiling made from old camping tents, three walls and a floor made of wooden pallets and other discarded materials he's gathered while living on the street.
Describe where we're at right now.
Right now we're on Wood Street and 24th.
How long have you been out here?
About 2 years.
How did you wind up becoming homeless? What's the story?
Well, I got evicted out of my house because my landlord went up on a rent. And then when I moved back in with my mother, my aunt and them decided that they wanted to remodel, and it took them a year. They just not finished. And I actually came over here to have Leon fixed my door on my camper because I had it in my mother's driveway, and the officer towed my van, and I end up being stuck here ever since.
What Messiah describes as being stuck has become the reality for many forced onto the street. Most formerly housed individuals say they're being pushed out of the city due to an influx of high-paid tech workers driving up housing prices. This reoccurring narrative of eviction due to skyrocketing rents has become the new face of displacement. And here in Oakland, the impacts of gentrification can be seen all over the city.
Yeah, so this is directly behind Target. There used to be one of the biggest encampments of the city of Oakland, and it started from right where that semi is, and it went on both sides of the street, and we're going to keep driving and driving and driving, and it ended here on this side. But this side kept on going, kept on going. See where they're parking all these cars? Up until, I mean, it just kept on going.
So we're talking about maybe like 8 blocks?
Yeah, this was a homeless encampment, and then it stopped right where that fence was, right here. So the city of Oakland and Operation Dignity evicted this entire encampment. And a lot of these spots, they're still like, you know, industrial businesses, but they're also live workplaces that a lot of the gentrifier folks have flipped into like mixed workspaces. Some of these folks who've moved in here, they're part of that whole NIMBY community. So most of these folks right here used to live in that encampment that we saw.
And that's Nita B, a housing advocate and founder of Feed the People, a volunteer-run advocacy group that provides life-sustaining services to the homeless community in Oakland. On this day, she took me on a ride-along through West Oakland, pointing out various encampments and describing how the city's approach to homelessness has re-traumatized the 100-plus homeless people living in nearby encampments by dismantling their makeshift homes to make way for a dog hotel.
This encampment area that there were, this used to be an encampment that we just drove by. Yes, the people were removed there because there is currently a dog hotel being built. And the owners of the dog hotel didn't want their customers to feel unsafe. That's a common thing we hear from new business owners that set up in our neighborhoods, whether it be near homeless encampments or near black and brown people, near low income people, that they don't want their clients to feel unsafe, but they're here for the community. So the owners of this new business didn't want their clients to feel unsafe, and also wanted to get rid of the humans, because right where the humans were living, they want to put a parking lot for their clients. So again, it's just like profit over people.
The housing crisis in Oakland is a racial equity issue that's complex and widespread. According to the Alameda County 2017 Homeless Person Point in Time Count, it's estimated that over 5,500 people experience homelessness and 3,800 are unsheltered, living in tents, parks, vehicles, vacant buildings, and underpasses, an increase of nearly 40% over the last count 2 years ago. The average person was an African-American man, 45 to 54 years old, able-bodied, unemployed, and in many cases struggling with mental health or substance abuse issues. Housing advocates like Nita B believes the city isn't being realistic in addressing the needs of Oakland's growing homeless population due to rising rents and a growing wealth gap.
Yeah, the city never offers people the alternative. What they want to say is, oh, we offered them shelter. We told them to go to a shelter. We told them to go to Henry J. Robinson. We told them to go to Operation Dignity. And the reality is, first of all, there's like at least 6,000 people. The city numbers and the county numbers say there's 2,000-something people who live on the streets of Oakland. But those are the people that they can see. When they do those census counts, they're not looking at the folks who live in the tunnels. They're not looking at there's an entire encampment that's just tree houses. Because they don't want people to find them, because they get harassed. So in East Oakland, there's an entire encampment of people living in trees. They weren't counted. The numbers that you hear about, like, oh, 2,000 people in the county of Alameda, those are just the folks that the people who do the counting can actually physically see. And so there's only 300 shelter beds in the city of Oakland, and there's at least 6,000 unhoused people. So first of all, there isn't enough room. Number two, people don't like going to the shelters because of the restrictions that are put on them. And like a lot of folks work at night or they have jobs during the day. You have to be in the shelter by 5 to get housing. And if you're working night or if you're working till 5, that doesn't work for you. Either it's a choice between quitting your job, which who wants to do that, or getting a bed for the night. People have pets. They don't want to go. You're not allowed in a shelter if you have pets. Folks who are families end up getting separated because men go to one shelter and women go to another shelter, and families don't want to be separated.
As Oakland officials discuss increased spending on programs and services for homeless people, including sanitation and trash services at particular encampments, many advocates say it isn't enough and are petitioning for the city to take a more progressive, humane stance that would provide low-income affordable housing, stronger eviction regulations that would prevent evictions without cause, and a minimum on rent increases annually. Housing advocates believe this is the first step in a good faith practice that would be beneficial to all Oakland residents, not just newcomers with deep pockets. For Making Contact, I'm Anita Johnson.
Cape Town is South Africa's second biggest city. Like cities in the U.S., when boutique businesses and higher housing costs start to show up in historically black and brown neighborhoods, it can point to changes for longtime residents. During apartheid, the government forcibly removed tens of thousands of people of color from the city. Today, gentrification is having a comparable effect because rising prices are driving evictions from working-class neighborhoods. Tony Andrews and Kimon DeGlieff follow the story through a sporting subculture with the notion of home at its center.
These are the birds that I've bred this year.
That's Riyad Najjar, an avid pigeon racer in Cape Town, South Africa. He's showing me and my co-producer, Kimon DeGlieff, around a large wooden enclosure known amongst racers as a loft. Riyad seems to have a strong connection with the birds.
Come.
He's jumped under your shoulder.
Yes, no.
Riyad comes in here every day from 4:30 a.m. to feed his pigeons and generally make sure that they're ready for the upcoming racing season. Waking up that early doesn't bother him, though. He says the birds calm him.
You hear that sound? You hear the sound? You know? And it's... You come in here, you leave everything there.
The birds are also a reminder of a painful time in his past. A time when neither his home nor that of his pigeons was secure. In a way, his pigeons have become a strange proxy for spatial dislocation in Cape Town. Back inside his house, Riyad tells us that he's been keeping pigeons since he was 4 years old.
I had my first pigeons in my mother's kitchen, under our eating table.
Riyad doesn't just love the pigeons for their peaceful demeanor. Part of what fascinates him is the incredible ability of specially bred varieties to find their way back to a specific location across vast distances. In a typical race, pigeons are transported in specially modified trucks to far-off locations and then released. Electronic devices then measure how fast the birds travel back to their loft.
No animal, besides probably dolphins and whales, has the ability to find its direction home for thousands of kilometers, having been at a particular place.
For Riyad, that place was a part of Cape Town called District 6. Right on the border with the downtown area, District 6 was a unique, bustling neighborhood with a racially diverse population.
It was such a rich childhood. We would play sport in the road. And the best sportsmen came from District 6. I mean, I played rugby. I went on to play for the South African team. And then at that time, rugby was separate.
By separate, he means racially separate. During apartheid, people from the various races in the country weren't allowed to mix. The apartheid government declared the area to be for white residents. People of color, who made up the vast majority, were forcibly removed, including Riyad.
Tell me about the last day you spent in your
prayers. Oh, that was just my father's birthday, and he said he wanted to have his last birthday still in the house in District 6. And it was a happy occasion for him, celebrating his birthday, but also a sad time. For us, I mean, we were very, very cut up. You would already see the neighbor's house gone and you were still standing, so you have to move because the guys on the job, they have to pull down your house.
Did you watch that happen to your house?
Well, I watched it happen to some of my other house, but I didn't see. I mean, it would have been too painful to watch that.
It's been 45 years since Riyad was forced to leave his home, and a lot has changed in South Africa in the meantime. In 1994, apartheid was abolished, and the country became a democracy. So in theory, everyone has been free to live wherever they want for 23 years. In practice, formerly white areas remain too expensive for people of color who are suffering the generational effects of apartheid inequality. Also, a recent property boom in the inner city caused rents to skyrocket, driving people of color out of small working-class enclaves that survived apartheid urban planning. We go to visit Woodstock, one of the gentrifying communities. Delia Adrian, who incidentally was born in District 6 just up the road, is being evicted from an apartment there that she shares with her family.
This is my last grandchild. Hello, baby. Say hello to the uncle there.
The building she lives in is in an advanced state of decay. The landlord clearly hasn't put much money in the upkeep for years. When a gust of wind blew the roof off 1 year, Delia says she had to replace the ceiling herself. Her 17 years in the apartment have been marked by similar disputes.
We're not paying rent now because the water has been disconnected. I'm stealing water, sir. Water isn't a luxury, it's a necessity. But the landlord owes the city so much money.
She and the other tenants are going to court this morning to get an update on the eviction proceedings.
That's all used to be houses. We disfected this easy.
As we drive down the road, her friend, Shahid Meisenheimer, points out the changes in the neighborhood, which is now dotted with coffee shops, microbreweries, and rustic furniture stores.
I used to stay here. It was houses right around here.
So the building has been demolished now?
Demolished, totally demolished. You can see what it looks like here.
Once we get to court, it takes several hours before anything happens. Eventually, they are told the case has been postponed for 2 weeks, and the limbo continues. The outcome that Delia and her neighbors are most terrified of is being sent to what the city terms a temporary relocation area. The most notorious of these is called Blikkiesdorp, literally meaning tin can town.
I've been to Blikkiesdorp. It's gangster infested now. The people shoot the human. I must take my well-bred grandchildren to Blikkiesdorp to become gangsters.
Gangster infested. That's what a lot of people say when you mention the area's name. For them, the purgatory of Blikkiesdorp feels more like hell. My partner Kimon and I head out to the settlement. The first problem, however, is that it's supposed to be a temporary site, so it's not listed on any maps, and we have to ask for directions.
We're looking for Blikkiesdorp.
A couple standing on the side of the road offers to get into the car and show us the way.
Thanks very much, eh?
One of them asks us in Afrikaans whether we've heard how rough the place is. He tells us to watch out for criminals and offers to keep an eye on us until we find the person we're planning to meet.
All right.
Once inside Blikkiesdorp, it becomes clear how it got its reputation. It's made up of regimented rows of shacks that extend over barren, sun-baked sand. One of the residents, Jane Roberts, comes out to meet us.
This is a dumping place for wherever you're getting evictions. They bring the people to this temporary location.
Jane shows us around the site, which has been divided up into sections. Each section is home to people from separate eviction rounds across the city, almost like a living museum of displacement. She can point out those who were brought here to make space for the 2010 Soccer World Cup, for example, or those who've been moved out of Woodstock. Near the end of our tour, a bunch of teenage boys from the settlement walks past us, and Jane immediately seems uncomfortable.
That is a gang.
Everybody knows they're in a gang, eh?
Everybody knows them.
Gangs are endemic in many poorer parts of Cape Town. The isolation of Blikkiesdorp, where strangers were thrust together from across the city, has given rise to new groups as residents vie for a sense of place. Next, Jane takes us to see her house, a 10 by 10 foot structure built from thin metal sheets, where she's been living for 8 years.
This is my house. In the winter time, in the summer it's hot, you can feel. In the summer it's very hot. In the winter time, it's very, very cold.
The city has stopped sending people to Blikkiesdorp, though there are other relocation sites performing the same function, all with a similar lack of services. For example, though the settlement receives electricity, the toilets, which are basically just outhouses, have to be shared by around 5 or 6 households. The toilet Jane showed us had a leak that spilled out into an area where children played.
It's not nice to stay here. People just want to come out of this place.
Listening to Jane, it's hard to ignore the similarities with Riyad Najjar's story, the pigeon race you heard in the beginning. Both experienced dislocation, but instead of rising rents, it was the apartheid state that drove Riyad from his home. When he watched the bulldozers chew through District 6 so many years ago, Riyad's mind turned immediately towards his beloved birds.
The pigeons was first on my mind.
Even after they moved to the new house, the pigeons still wanted to go back to the old house, their biological home.
I would take my bicycle, get to town, and they would all be sitting on the plot, you know, just exactly at the same spot.
There are a few methods that racers use to condition pigeons to accept a new location as their home, and Riyad tried all of them. But despite his best efforts, some birds just couldn't get used to the new place.
I don't know if they had the same feeling that we had, you know, the pigeons. It's funny. Thinking about it now, they probably also felt a sense of loss.
Riyad believes the pigeons' iron will to get home contains lessons for the whole country.
We should all in this country have a will to make it a better place for everyone. And if we have the same determination and fortitude to achieve that, this would be the county of Mulkanani.
What exactly that looks like is open to interpretation. Riyadh recognizes that solving the challenges of gentrification won't be easy. But then again, toppling apartheid wasn't either. It will take a monumental effort to make this country feel like home for all South Africans. And in Cape Town, if we don't fight the headwinds of market trends that reinforce old apartheid patterns, it's unlikely we'll ever get there. For Making Contact, we are Tony Andrews and Kimon de Grieff in Cape Town, South Africa.
And that's it for this week's show. I'm your host, Monica Lopez. For more information, go to radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Good morning. It is just 1 minute before noon, and you are tuned in to KBOO Portland. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not yet a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And now, stay tuned for noon headlines, followed by Noontime Jamboree.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, July 17, 2017, in local news. The Portland metro area construction boom continues to be one of the largest in the country. More than 12,000 building permits valued at $2.5 billion were issued in the first 10 months of this fiscal year alone. The 21 high-rise construction cranes currently dotting the area skyline are the fifth most in use in the country. Despite the huge construction boom, rents and home sales continue to increase rapidly in the Portland area. Average rents are up more than 60% since 2010, and the Portland real estate market is considered to be the third hottest in the country after Denver and Seattle, with most homes sold within the first 7 days of being on the market. The hot real estate market has led to buyers competing for homes, with more than 25% of all homes sold at a premium to the list price. In addition to the hot residential market, the Portland area has seen a boom in the construction of hotels, with 15 currently in the works. Several large public construction projects are also fueling the construction boom. Multnomah County is building a new $300 million courthouse. The City of Portland is renovating the Portland building at a cost of $200 million.